Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, we go away for 2 weeks and all hell breaks loose here in D.C. From super committee to super blunder, from worst to first, Gingrich is back in play. Snipers shooting at the White House, pepper spray. My God, my head is about to explode with all these things that we have to talk about. And, of course, tell me a story. Today on Backroom Politics. And it's Tuesday here in Washington, D.C., in the heart of our nation's capital. It's 4 o'clock on the East Coast. That means it's time for America's premier roundtable talk show on the Internet. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me, as they do every Tuesday, except for the past 2 weeks, where we've taken a little bit of a break for vacations and business travel. To my left, he is the former 8th-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
Welcome back.
How was your break?
My break was wonderful.
Good. Sitting to my 11 o'clock, as he does every Tuesday, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is a longtime member of Hill staff and a longtime Washington insider. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, welcome back.
Oh, nice to be back with you guys.
Thanks. How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, it was fabulous. I was in Chicago.
Oh, because nothing says, you know, going back to the Pilgrims like Chicago.
and Michigan Avenue on Black Friday.
Did you tell Rom we said hello? It's a kinder, gentler Rom. to my direct across the table, he is the longtime political insider. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He's the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you, Justin. It's always good to be here.
Did you enjoy the homestead, sir?
I certainly did. I recommend it to anybody.
I hope you and Gail had a good time. Yeah, I went there for Thanksgiving. And to my right, back after a long hiatus, I guess he had to think of stuff to talk about, longtime Hill staffer, longtime political insider, he is John Fresh. And John, welcome back.
Thanks.
It's nice to have a Democrat back at the
table. Talking's never a problem, but I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, and on behalf of the Republicans, I want to say we're glad to have John back.
We are glad to have John back. I am your moderator, Justin Russell, and today we're going to start off with, God, there's so much to talk about. We go away for 2 weeks and all chaos breaks loose in D.C. The big story that we wanted to talk about, it's a little old right now since it kind of dropped off while we were on hiatus, is the super blunder that is the super committee. They just took a nosedive. Bob, what happened?
What we thought would happen, what happened?
Okay, I want to have a little bit of humility saying, hey, we called it 3 weeks ago. But in reality, what happened? What caused the downfall of what was supposed to be a gang of 12 people that were supposed to have common sense, supposed to have compromise, and it just went south like a bat out of hell?
Well, I think it's reasonable to say that both sides had bottom lines that they were not willing to move away from unless they got a great big response from the other side, and neither side was able to make as big a proposal as might have been expected or hoped for. And I think that it's not a question of, I don't think it's fair to blame anybody. It's just the fact that they could not reach agreement.
Now,
I don't think it's unfair to blame the leadership. I think that you had the Simpson Bowles, and they had a number of members of Congress on that committee that voted for the things that needed to be done.
As a matter of fact, it was a majority, but not the supermajority they needed.
Not a one of them was on this super committee. On the other hand, you had the other same thing, and four of the people who voted against that were on the committee. So the leadership was picking negatives, both from the left and the right, to put on the super committee, and that meant it started in a hole to begin with.
Alan, what's your take? What happened? You agree with that?
Well, I think that was an important factor, but I think Bob really hit it on the head when he said neither side got enough from the other side. Remember, there was a fallback here. We ended up, at one point, some of us were hoping that they would think a lot bigger than the $1.2 trillion, and then it became increasingly clear that $1.2 was going to be a stretch. There is a $1.2 spending cut that's sitting out there staring us in the face. And so if you're those who felt like you didn't want to go very far on the tax side, this was a way to lay it all on spending. And as far as those who wanted to protect the entitlements, this particular approach doesn't affect entitlements that very much, and it does hit defense pretty hard, which is a problem for a lot of Republicans in particular, not such a problem for Democrats. So the fallback position was one that both sides concluded was a better outcome than giving up as much as they would have had to give to get a deal. It's unfortunate it's an opportunity missed.
John, what's your take on that?
Well, it's three strikes and you're out. I mean, we had Simpson Bowles, didn't work. We had Boehner Obama, didn't work. We have the super committee, didn't work. Everybody in America knows what we need to do. We need to get in the same boat, raise some revenue, cut some entitlements over the long term, cut spending. We need to do it equally. We need to have balance. And it's clear that, and I don't agree that you can't blame anybody, one iota, I don't believe that. You know, Congress is not stepping up to the plate to do their job, and it's a job that everybody knows needs to be done. And, you know, where we go from here, we should come back to this because I don't want to dwell on it, but you're going to have the biggest lobbying campaign you've ever seen in your life on those defense cuts. That is an established lobby. They have good points to make. They have good people. They're worried. You know, Gates and Panetta wants to do the cuts in a reasonable way, not in a meat axe way, and now we're just going to have a free-for-all in 2012.
Well, you brought up Secretary Panetta. Secretary Panetta said that this cut is going to be detrimental to national security. Is that a little bit of saber-rattling on Panetta's part, or do you really believe this, Bob?
Leon Panetta is not a saber-rattler. He's a pretty serious guy, and he's got a lot of respect on both sides of the aisle and in both houses. And he's a pretty damn solid citizen. And the guy who went before him, Gates, he's following basically the same pattern Gates did. You know, take a good hard look at things and see what needs to be done. Gates did a lot of cutting. But that is standing right with him. He says we need to do those cuts. We're going to continue. But he said the kind of cuts that's going to be required under the trigger is more than we ought to be doing. It's not a good idea. Now, this is a Democrat. I am sure that some of his colleagues, former colleagues in the Congress, are unhappy that he's saying that, but I think he's probably right, because I don't think Leon Panetta is a guy who is going to say something he doesn't think is true, and he's got a lot of experience on Capitol Hill and at the CIA. He knows these issues. I think he's probably right, and it's going to be a problem.
Alan,
what's particularly interesting here, though, is you've got Panetta and a lot of other defense folks who are saying we cannot sustain those kind of cuts. At the same time, you've got the president who, in my opinion, and people will have different views of this, stood off, had a greater standoffish role here than I think was warranted given the way things were going, but debatable point. What the president has said is, I will veto any legislation that changes these automatic cuts.
Well, let's talk about that for a second.
I don't think that's going to be the way this plays out.
Let's talk about that for a second, because the fact is, as Alan pointed out, the president came out literally that day and said, I'll veto anything you guys try and do to save defense spending. Does the president have enough credibility right now, John Freshman, to make that call?
Out of the first half, I'm going to torture my baseball analogy to death. First half of the first out of the first inning means nothing.
Wow. Al, do you agree with that?
I think that what the president may well have been doing is is letting him know that they have missed great opportunities and that he is not going to put up with a lot of dickering around. I doubt if he seriously meant that he would make as deep cuts there, but he meant that you're not going to go in there and cherry pick this thing, or he will veto it.
But Bob, we've seen President Obama. He's actually had some credibility when it comes to defense issues. He was the person who actually got Osama bin Laden. His approach in Libya was arguably successful. The one area where he does have some strength and some stroke would be defense. Why would he go out and put a "I will veto defense spending if you try it" on the block and cut his nose off to spite his face? Is this a bad move?
What I suspect is that he laid a card on the table. Okay, I'll make you a bet that he doesn't have to veto it, because I'll make you a bet that the White House and Leon Panetta and the leadership in Congress will figure out, something to make everybody happy. There'll probably be some cuts, but there won't be too much different than what the guys on the Hill and Panetta think is wise.
Yeah, but
I'm guessing it.
Congressman Al, I mean, when Bob says they're going to come up with something that's going to make everybody happy, they've had the opportunity to do something that'll make everybody happy. They had the opportunity with Simpson Bowles. They had the opportunity with Obama Boehner. The Super Committee had that opportunity. Why now that we're in overtime do we have to find something that will make everybody happy?
Bob would probably like to ask unanimous consent to revise and extend his remarks and state that just a little differently.
What I would state is maybe it won't make everybody happy, but on Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, there's a majority in both bodies to protect the Defense Department within reason.
But, John, the question still stands. I mean, why now in overtime do we have to go and make at least a majority of the people happy?
Well, you can't. We've learned that. I mean, it's three strikes. You can't do it. And what we're going to have is a stalemate. And the Wall Street Journal, which I read and which is very good, had an editorial that said, well, obviously we can't, agree in Congress. We understand that what we need is an election. Well, we're going to have an election. And what's going to happen is the Republicans are going to get the Senate more or less 52-48. Democrats are going to pick up more or less 30 seats in the House. Whoever wins the presidency is going to win a very close election. And we're not going to have the constituency to make the kind of changes we need at all. We're going to continue to have divided government. I mean, there's an absolute absence of leadership. Everybody knows what we need to do here, and they're not willing to do it. It's discouraging.
Alan, how detrimental is this to the credibility of Congress right now? Was this the last straw?
When you start with 9% approval, and you wonder, who is that 9%? You don't have a long way down to go. So in that regard, I don't know what the final straw would be. Everybody says, throw them all out. Well, we threw a bunch of them out in 2010, and we've got the current.
It certainly did not improve.
The current situation. So we're going to continue to sort of muddle through here, and we are in full presidential election mode right now, and that is an additional complication layered on top of the really hard decisions that have to be made. John says everybody knows what we have to do. Maybe, but the devil's in the details, and I think that's really the challenge. How much in taxes, where in taxes, how much in spending, how much in the entitlements. And this group here might be able to come up with a resolution of that if we were all powerful, but it's clear that in the Congress they are not there yet.
Well, it's funny, Al, when we talk about who, if there's blame to go around, one of the names that we heard that actually may have been the death nail is Grover Norquist. His tax pledge has been thrown all over the place. Is it right to have somebody like a Grover Norquist have that much pull over a super committee in a fiscal crisis that we have right now?
Well, it's not right, and for a slightly different reason. That many members of Congress would essentially give their proxy to an unelected person outside the Congress.
I mean, let's call it what he is. He's a lobbyist.
Yeah. Give a hard, fast proxy to somebody outside the Congress is, I think, a dereliction of their responsibility as members of Congress. I think Robert Norquist, as a citizen, has got a right to try and do whatever he wants to do. It's the people that he that went along with him that are the ones that should be, putting the stocks.
Be that as it may, he won.
Yeah, but I mean,
he won.
But now,
yes,
now
did.
We've got somebody like Grover Norquist who is going around saying, "Hey, I beat this. You know what? They're not raising taxes.
He won."
Why does somebody like Grover Norquist, who arguably does not have any skin in this game, he's never been elected, he hasn't held public office, he hasn't been appointed to anything that I know of, where does this guy get his stroke like this, other than having a bunch of congressmen sign what was basically a piece of fax paper that says, "I won't raise taxes"?
Power bores a vacuum. He's filled a vacuum because there's no leadership.
Wow. Alan, you agree with that?
I actually do, and I know where people like to talk about Norquist as though this one guy that nobody knows much about has all this power. I think it was he happened to be in a particular place with a particular point of view at a time where, as John says, there was a vacuum. If it wasn't Grover Norquist, it could have been somebody else who had been advancing this thing. So we're overstating his role and understating this concern that the Tea Party represents and a lot of other people fear about going too far on taxes. I'm not saying we are going too far on taxes, but there is that fear, and there's a history of raising taxes and raising spending at the same time, not showing the discipline on either side.
Bob?
It isn't so much that Grover Norquist has so much power. It's that the membership of the Congress is unwilling to take the hard decisions. We, fundamentally, it's a failure of the membership of the House and the Senate. I think Al is exactly right. Their responsibility is to vote on issues that come before them. You can duck all you want. You can hide behind Grover Norquist. But the responsibility of the United States Congress, House and Senate, is to solve the problems that we've got. And right now, it's a budgeting problem. It's a revenue problem. We are not solving the problem. And as John says, it's a failure.
All right, John?
Well, it's back at us again in the Senate, where you have the Social Security payroll tax cut that they're trying to extend, and they want to do the pay for by raising the tax on millionaires, whatever that means. And, you know, this issue is just going to be over and over again until we're going to scream in agony because we can't stand to hear it anymore. And the only way to resolve it details, you know, I think what you do is you let the Bush tax cuts expire. I mean, that's the referendum. That's the real referendum. Yeah.
But
on everybody?
Do the Republicans
just
have
let them expire?
The Republicans right now have enough metal, Alan, to actually make that happen.
Well, it's not up to the Republicans.
They don't
right
want
now,
it to happen.
They do expire
yes.
at the end of 2012.
Yeah.
They have to be affirmatively extended, and that's going to be a huge challenge. I think the president, I mean, you've heard me say before, I think the president made a mistake last time around when he agreed to extend them.
Right.
Because he could have played the game of chicken a different way. He could have let them all expire and then said, "Gang, I don't like this, but I'm not going to go with your way. Let's find a compromise." But having collapsed once, I think the notion is he'll do it again. I wanted to say one other thing, though, about Republicans and Grover Norquist. People on the Hill don't believe that they are following Grover Norquist. They resent the fact that he is being portrayed as somehow their guide dog, but in fact, they don't believe that the options on the table are the right thing for this country at this point in time. They don't ignore the fact that they might have signed onto this pledge, but they're not holding out because they signed a pledge. They're holding out because they have a difference of opinion on what makes the most sense right now.
But, I mean, Congressman Al, appearance is everything here in Washington, and the appearance is that Grover Norquist has got the entire Republican leadership being led around by a nose ring.
Well, I'm sorry if these Republicans feel, that they're being ill-used. They signed the pledge. Now, let me use an example. I have been pro-choice on that very controversial issue all my life. And I would state it publicly over and over and over again. Had the pro-choice people came to me with a pledge to sign, I wouldn't have signed it. I just don't think you give away your vote, your right to negotiate, your right to change your mind, your right to deal with different factors that come up. And so signing Grover Norquist's pledge was wrong, I think morally, but at least it was certainly wrong,
you know,
I think politically.
I've got a couple of friends who are running for Congress as a result of redistricting. One of them, our friend Dakota Wood, and in confidence, and I told him I was going to talk about this, I told him, you know, if anybody comes to you with a pledge and a piece of paper and a pen, don't sign it, because you have a responsibility to represent your constituents. If you're signing a pledge by one special interest group, you're basically signing off your credibility of being a person for the people, for your constituency. I would think, and I'm not a genius, I'm by no means a political insider, I would think if somebody like me can give that advice, it would be advice that everybody on the Hill would take. Bob, why are people being pressured to follow these ideologues?
In many cases, it's because, if you're a moderate Republican and somebody on the right signs the pledge and makes a big stink about it, then the moderate is faced with a situation of sounding like he's not against raising taxes just willy-nilly for any crazy reason, so to speak. So the situation is he gets a little nervous, and that's why they sign. They think it's easy to sign, and they think they'll never get to a situation
where
they're getting locked in, I guess.
But if you listen to Grover Norquist, and I'd love to get off this when you're ready, Mr. Moderator. Well, I think there's other things to talk about.
There are.
If you listen to him, he makes a lot of sense. He's a terrific advocate for his point of view. And his point of view is it's a refinement and a further articulation of the old Reagan view that if you bring him money, they will spend it. And you don't want to do that. If you don't give them money, they won't spend it. And he says every time we've had a deal that was supposed to be tax cuts and budget cuts, tax increases and budget cuts, the tax increases happened and the budget cuts didn't happen. And give the guy some credit he's intellectually consistent. I don't give the people that follow him any credit. But he's intellectually consistent. He's consistent over time. He's articulate. But he has absolutely the wrong notion of what we need to do to get this country out of this mess now. He's simply wrong. He's smart. He's articulate. He's wrong.
Alan.
I want to say a word about why I think people sell their souls and sign on to some of this stuff. And I think it has to do with our crazy electoral system and process. To win in a primary, you're dealing with a very small number of people. And the ones who make the most noise and who are most active can have a disproportionate influence. If some of those put a high premium on signing some kind of a pledge or other, people will often make a judgment very early on that I'd rather be in the game and have a chance at victory, if that's their assessment, I'll sign on to their pledge, and then they'll have to deal with the consequences thereafter. You can look. I'm not defending people from doing that, but some of the people who are in office now are in office probably in some part because they were willing to sign on to this crazy thing.
Well, let's go back to the super committee as a whole. Does the failure of the super committee now give Erskine, Simpson Bowles a lot more credibility, and will we see Simpson Bowles be resurrected? John?
That ship has sailed.
Alan?
I agree. That doesn't mean that the ideas that are there won't continue to come forward, but the details have sailed.
Congressman Al?
I wish it would, but I don't think it will.
Bob?
I wish it would, but I don't think the ship has sailed. I think it's sunk.
Wow. That's a very negative aspect. I haven't heard you go that negative in a while.
For months thought that the president had missed a huge opportunity by not adopting the report of his own commission. And don't want to beat a point, but the fact of the matter is it's still probably the most balanced suggestions. It's a package that have been put together.
Well, John, go ahead.
With a fast-track rule.
Well, but here's the question now.
That's really important.
You
just needed 51 votes in the Senate.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree about the failure of leadership on the part of the president on Simpson Bowles. That was just sitting there waiting to take. We wouldn't be doing this now. We wouldn't be having this conversation now. 51 votes is all he needed in a majority in the House. I can't
well,
think of what that
we've
is.
Talked about how it's going to affect the credibility or lack. Well, we've talked about how the failure of the super committee is going to affect the credibility or lack thereof with the American electorate for Congress. What we haven't talked about is the decisive, if you listen to the talking heads here in town, the decisive lack of leadership coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania and out of the administration. Is that a fair blame to place on the president, Al?
Well, I don't know. With the decisive lack of leadership coming from both parties in both houses, if you measure him against that, he's looking pretty good.
Damn him with faint praise.
Yeah. Sure. That's kind of a backhanded compliment, Al.
Well, I think that the president has shown some leadership on some things that are unpopular, and so people say that he's not leading. You know, he was criticized, for example, for not putting the United States in the forefront of the North Africa whole effort. We were there.
Leading from behind.
We were leading from behind, and there were people saying, you know, that this was wrong. I thought it was brilliant. It was certainly leadership, and after my whole life we've said we can't be policemen to the world, and so somebody finally gets Germany and France to take the lead, and then they bitch about it. I think that's leadership.
Well, on that score, I think the big mistake of somebody inside the White House was to coin the phrase leading from behind, because what it did was diminish our allies. It said, well, we've got them out front, but we're running things from behind. You can't have it both ways, and that was just a stupid thing they did. Back to the super committee for a moment, though. I think that whether this is a huge disaster and perceived as such depends on how the markets respond, how the economy responds. Well, you know what's saving the Congress right now in this failure is the disaster economically going on in Europe. People are still looking to America for leadership. Any money that people want to invest safely comes here. So some of the things we most feared about a failure here didn't come about because we're still the safest place to park money, A, and B, we still have a plan in the law to cut spending by that $1.2 trillion. We'll see if it survives. I don't think it will, but my point in all of that is it's not clear that this is going to do some kind of horrible damage to one party or the other or to incumbents or not, because people are saying, wow, what a disaster.
Well, let me go around the horn and ask a simple question, because there are no winners right now in the failure of the super committee, but who loses the least with this failure? Is it the White House? Is it a certain member of Congress? Is it Grover Norquist? Al?
No, I think the White House loses the least.
Right.
Al?
I agree.
Bob?
I agree.
John?
I think serious proponents of tax reform, of whom there are many, most notably the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, who happens to be a serious man who would like to do tax reform separate, loses the most because he doesn't have a forum any longer to do what he was trying to do as a result of the failure of the super committee and the rabid anti-tax increase sentiment of the Republican Party, whether it's decided by Grover Norquist or whether they decide it themselves.
Does this actually help the president in his reelection campaign?
Oh, sure.
Is it enough to put him over the top?
Oh, that we should talk about.
We're coming up on the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. When we come back, big news over the past 24 hours. Barney Frank is the latest to announce that he is not going to seek re-election in the next congressional race up in Massachusetts. It is a long list of people running from Capitol Hill. We're going to talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. And we're live back here at Chili's Back Room in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics. We're going to talk a little bit now about the big news coming off of Capitol Hill. Longtime member of Congress representing the great constituency of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Barney Frank, has announced that he will not seek re-election for his seat, which is big, big news coming off the Hill. I want to go to the Democrats first. I want to say, Congressman Allen, does this surprise you?
Yeah, it really does surprise me. But then I hadn't realized he was 71 years old, you know. And being a little older than that, you do get tired after a while. But he's exactly the kind of person we need, liberal or conservative. I mean, the kind of person in terms of being able to make a deal and sit down and understand another person's point of view and make suggestions. He's exactly the kind of person that Congress needs.
John, does this surprise you, the announcement of Barney Frank? You've been around the Hill a long time.
No, I think we're going to see a lot of retirements. I think the 9% has got a lot of people discouraged. I think it's difficult to have been a committee chairman and go into the minority after you've had a chance to run it. You kind of look, and it doesn't appear as though the Democrats are going to take back the House anytime soon. And I think you're going to see, you know, more of them. I think you're going to see... the other one that I think is fascinating, he hasn't announced it yet, but it's likely we're going to lose another, in my opinion, great congressman, David Dreyer, who's the chairman of the House Rules Committee, because they did a redistricting in California with the Citizens Commission, and he doesn't have anywhere to run.
Well, I mean, you've got Barney Frank, you've got Dreyer, you've got...
If it happens,
you've got Gonzalez down in San Antonio. He's decided he's not going to run for re-election.
There's a lot of them in the Senate, too.
A lot in the Senate they're going to start pulling out, and there's probably going to be more. Alan, is this a hemorrhaging of experience that Congress can afford to lose right now?
You know, I look back in the last 10, 12, pick some years, and you see a lot of leaders going. New leaders are coming in, I hope. They're hard to recognize so far, but that doesn't mean they won't be there. But I think, you know, that, as Al says, Frank is 71 years old. As John says, he's gone from the majority to the minority, which is a big step down in the House of Representatives. And he also was redistricted. He would win, but as I heard him say this morning on television, he said, I got 350,000 new constituents. If I could just work on the stuff I cared about over the next year here in Washington, I would probably run again. But I would have to spend an enormous amount of my time meeting my new constituents. That's not worth it to me. And then I'd be 75 by the time I finished up in a couple of years. It's a good time to go.
But Al, I mean, Barney Frank isn't exactly an unknown commodity in Massachusetts, let alone national political scene. He could have won that easily with or without his 350,000 new constituents. Can we find somebody that could replace the legacy, the caricature that is Barney Frank?
No, any more than we can replace Dave Obie or Henry Hyde or any of these others. They're unique people, and you can't just... it's not like plugging in... things in a chessboard. But the concept that there is new talent coming on is true, and it will begin to demonstrate itself.
Sure.
I think some has. We've got a chairman of the Ways and Means Committee that is pretty well respected and so forth. So they will take over. I think that the loss of Barney Frank comes... in a couple of years, he was a great congressman, but he was also a great character. And one of the things that Congress is in desperate need of is a few characters.
Right.
I mean, Charlie Wilson is gone, Tip is gone, and go back into the era before that. The Senate is all made up of people who act like bankers rather than the senators we used to know. And Barney is a witty, funny, acerbic guy. I will in a minute tell a story.
We'll tell that story at the end of the segment. But Bob, you know, when we see the names that are leaving, it's not new blood. It's the old school members that were willing to make deals, that were willing to compromise, that were willing to get to know each other because they were back in the day of the old Codells, etc. With the current state of politics right now, does the departure of all of the, for lack of a better term, and everybody around the table is going to hit me, gray hairs, are we losing the gray hairs that could possibly bring Congress back to a point where it can get out of that basement of credibility?
Who knows? Truly. I don't have any idea. But take, for example, we had 80-some Republicans, 83 elected last year. We're going to lose some older and some of that younger group because the Democrats will probably pick some House seats up. So there could be maybe 20, 25 new Democrats. If that's the case, again, you're going to have two classes, one a very large class, one a pretty good sized class. Now, 8 or 10 years from now, you're going to take a look at those groups. You're going to say, gee, there's 3 or 4 guys and gals who are looking pretty good. They seem to know what they're doing. They seem to be good legislators. They could be leaders. You can't tell. I mean, there's a whole lot of these people in the Republican Party that quote the Tea Party guys and gals. I mean, people are saying, oh, you know, these gals are all crazy. Well, they're not. There are some pretty responsible people who've come in, and we'll see them, but we won't see them as a leader position, maybe for a decade at least.
John?
Nobody was born gray. You know, it takes a while. You know, you have to be here for a while to establish your leadership. And we don't know. I agree with him.
Alan.
Hey, if the current gray hairs were so damn great about pulling things together, we wouldn't be entirely.
Good point. Al?
Well, I was going to make the point that I don't think that gray hairs in any case take you back to moving forward. They are, you know, guys like John Dingell.
Who's another name that might be in trouble.
Who might be, and who is in some people's judgment, including his former Republican opposite, one of the great congressmen that have ever existed in the history of the country. But you're not going to see a John Dingell lead a reform that's going to change things. It's the day is past. The gray hairy 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 hairy
1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. After a little minor technical problem, we have those from time to time here on Backroom Politics, and we always get through them. But we want to continue the discussion from last segment on Barney Frank's announcement that he is, in fact, pulling out of his race in Massachusetts. One of the questions that comes up, though, is something that we've talked about here on Backroom Politics, is the issue of redistricting. The obvious question is, we've heard bunch of senior members say they're not seeking re-election. However, if they are not seeking re-election, can we blame a little bit of this on redistricting, Bob?
Well, I think yes. I think we would, as we spoke about earlier, Mr. Frank said, in effect, you know, I'm 71 and I've got a whole lot of new potential constituents, and it's going to be difficult. Redistricting is always, no matter who does it, no matter how it's done, there's always going to be some changes, and some people are going to find they have a district that they don't like, or they don't have a district, and it's going to force some people to retire.
John?
Can I say one more thing?
Oh, yeah, please.
Speaking as a Republican about Barney Frank, he is one I've always thought, and I did not know him well, and I don't know that he'd be able to pick me out of a group of three, maybe even two, but I've always respected him because He had several things that every congressman have and unfortunately don't. He had a good mind. He was very smart. He knew the issues. He knew the politics. And he knew how to cut deals. Deals that obviously were he was trying to get the best deal he could get for his side. But he was the kind of guy who would not, you know, go to the extremes. He was always, in my mind, a pretty, you know, liberal, but a reasonable and sensible guy. And boy, we could use reasonable and sensible guys and gals on both sides of the aisle.
No question about that, Alan.
I was going to, there's something about ironic about Franks, just and it reminds me a little bit of Ted Kennedy. They were both very effective legislators. They were both very engaging guys. They could both work across the aisle. But they also had sharp tongues, which they would use from time to time, and they could cut and harm with their tongue. But having said that, partly because of that, they also became popular targets for Republicans. If you wanted to cut a deal in the Senate, you cut the deal with Ted Kennedy. If you wanted to raise money as a Republican, you attacked Ted Kennedy. And
right.
People have been doing the same thing with Barney Frank for years.
Right.
You go cut your deals with him, but you also
vilify him
as your foil and vilify him. And he gave ample ammunition for doing that. Let's not pretend otherwise.
That's true. Al, you served with Barney Frank in Congress. I'm sure you've got a couple of good stories about Barney Frank.
The sharp tongue. Brings to mind we were trying to do the final passage on a House Senate conference committee that the Democratic liberals decided wasn't good enough, and the Democratic leadership, John Foley was speaker, really wanted this to pass. It was the last vote of the evening, and they finally asked Barney Frank, who'd been a member of the conference committee, if he would speak because of the liberal credentials you talked about. And he did, and it was a brilliant speech. He said, "Do you really think you're going to send anything back to that tower of jello and it is going to come out better than when you sent it in?" And all of the Democrats who were against him said, "Oh, damn," and they voted for it, holding their nose. And they left the chamber. And for reasons I don't recall, I was still hanging around down in the well when the speaker in the chair, Tom, beckoned Barney and called him up to the speaker. And I could overhear him say, "Barney, you really did violate the rules by the way you referred to the Senate, because you're supposed to call it the other body and so forth, and you're certainly not supposed to insult it. Those are in the rules." And he said, "If you do me a great personal favor in terms of our relationship with the Senate, if you wouldn't mind asking a permission to speak and apologize." And Barney said, "Mr. Speaker, I'll be happy to do that." Turned around, took one step, and grabbed Dennis Eckhart of Ohio and whispered something into his ear. And Eckhart fell on his knees, I mean, just with laughter. So I sat down to see what was going on. Well, they did a few more little bitsy things, and then Barney asked unanimous consent to speak out of order for 1 minute and gave an absolutely straight apology. He said, "I violated the rules by my reference to the other body as a tower of jello, and I apologize sincerely." At which point Eckhart says, "Would the gentleman yield?" And Frank says, "I'd be delighted to yield to my friend from Ohio." And his friend from Ohio, Eckhart, says, "Don't you also owe an apology to General Foods?"
See, we don't get stories like that anymore.
And Foley sits in the chair and rolls his eyes.
That's a great story. It's too bad because we miss stories like that about people like Barney Frank. You can say the same thing about Senator Byrd when he was in. You say on both sides of the aisle, there are always great always great stories about Charlie Wilson, Tip. Even some of your friends out in Washington, Scoop Jackson, etc. It's too bad that we're losing some of the old gray hairs, I like to call them. But one of the questions I do have to ask is, who's next in line behind Barney Frank on banking? That's the big question. That's the $10,000 question. That's a bigger mess than we thought it would be.
And if he...
John, what are you? How would you handicap how this is going to turn out?
And would he have left the committee to those vagaries had he still been in the majority?
That's actually a very good question. Yeah. John, I ask you that question.
No.
Would he have left? No.
If he was still chairman, he wouldn't have left.
But
who's behind... In part because of the... leadership gap that could develop.
But who's behind him as ranking member?
Maxine Waters is the next in line.
Alan, do you think she's got sustainability to actually become the ranking member?
I actually, you know, I'm not the not an expert on the House, so I can say with great authority, no, she will not, she will not advance. She's got this ethical cloud hanging over her.
She's still under investigation.
You will recall, she's still under investigation. She intervened with the executive branch to get some special treatment for a bank out in her district,
right,
in which her husband was an officer and a shareholder, and it would look pretty outrageous. Even when Barney Frank apparently said, "Lay off of this, let me help,"
yes.
Which people have kind of ignored,
right,
and forgotten about,
right,
she stuck her nose in anyway. I think that cloud is so dark and wide that she will not become the next chair, and that's something that the Democratic next ranking, excuse me, and potential chair, something that the caucus, all of the members will decide, and I think this is a case where she won't. But Al's the expert.
Congressman Al.
I totally agree with that. It is the ethical cloud that would stop her as a black woman. If she did not have that ethical cloud, I don't think there's any way you could stop her, any more than you could stop Ron Dellums from becoming chairman of the Armed Services Committee.
But he was a great chairman.
And he turned out to be.
I'm not so sure that analogy holds up.
Well,
maybe not in the quality of leadership,
but
at least
back in the day,
what we're hearing
is
an issue.
I was trying to be more civil.
Right. Well, okay, we got that too. Bob, I mean, you've been around the floor. What's your take? Can Maxine Waters actually come up and be a sustainable ranking member with the investigation still looming?
I don't think so. I think it would, and I don't think from a political standpoint it would be wise for the Democrats to do so, because it would just indicate that, you know, it doesn't make any difference if you're ethically challenged or not. We'll put you in a position of authority just because you're the person next in line. I think they ought to. I think any party would not want to have that happen during an election year.
I wonder if she could even get very enthusiastic support out of the Black Caucus.
Well, let's remember, we're a year away from these decisions being made, and I hope that her situation will have been resolved by then. And if she should prevail, and I think we're assuming she won't, or that she won't prevail with totally clean hands, there will be some kind of sanction, is what our expectation is, but we better not prejudge that. If the committee should clear her, then I think she's totally back in the mix.
Yeah.
My hunch is she won't be totally cleared, which is why.
Now, there are other names that have got some stroke on the committee. Maloney out of New York, I know, is one of them that could possibly come up. Who else could possibly take that reign should Maxine Waters be deemed censured or disciplined by the House?
There are two Hispanics behind that.
Woman from
there's a man from Chicago who is Hispanic, who's I remember when he came as a freshman, a real firebrand at the time.
Gutierrez?
Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's
you're talking about Mike
developed all that seniority now.
Yeah.
You're talking about Luis Gutierrez from the fourth in Illinois.
Luis, yeah.
You know, there's a bunch of players here. How important is Maxine Waters to getting stuff through financial services?
I don't think anybody in the minority of that committee is important at all. I don't think this is an important problem or an important decision. As long as they're in the minority and you have a strong majority, you know, the way the House works is, you know, I don't think it's a big deal. And I do agree with you about Waters, but I don't think it's important compared to other things that are going on. You were talking earlier about sort of next generation of leaders, though.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one young guy who's going to be a terrific leader is Kevin McCarthy, who took Chairman Bill Thomas's place from the Central Valley of California. He's absolutely a terrific guy. He's a leader. He doesn't march in lockstep with the others. You know, all the light goes on, you know, Eric Cantor. But you watch Kevin McCarthy. He's good. He's smart. He knows how to work the process.
Still fairly young.
Very young.
Very young.
What a member of leadership.
Yeah, I mean, plus, you know, coming out of California 22, he's got a lot of base down there that he can play with, too.
And the Democrat side, Chris Van Hollen, is clearly a comer who's going to be a leader.
Yes. Another one. With all the departures of all the senior people, we thought, again, I want to go back to the redistricting issue, because it's obviously an issue that Gutierrez is dealing with down in Texas. Barney Frank Gonzalez down in Texas. You're talking about Barney Frank now. Redistricting is probably going to be a problem for your friend out in Michigan. They got serious problems. Does this now bring us to a point where we have to relook at redistricting as a whole, as a political issue, or do we just let it continue? This is just a fluke.
Well, I would point out that someone mentioned here one of the reasons the Dreyer is having problems is because
California has done it. They
did redistrict
it. I've been talking about it on this show for...
You know, and they did redistrict it, right? And a good member got caught in the pincers of it. So
and Texas is in court.
Texas is in court, and also in California, you've got two sitting congressmen, very senior, Howard Berman and Brad Sherman, who are now in the same district, and they are going to probably have the most expensive congressional race in the country, because they will spend millions in their primary, and then they will have to they will go to a general against someone.
So they will go probably against each other, because they'll probably be the two top vote-getters. Remember, in California...
Thank you. California wants to be more like Louisiana.
Same problem that John Dingell's going to have is he's going up on a redistricting issue. He's going to have a fight with another long-standing member in his district now.
Texas, which is the crucible of political redistricting, if you saw the very effective moves that Tom DeLay did to oust all of those Democrats in one election... Whether you like him or not, the hammer got that little thing done. But what a lot of people don't know about Texas is fascinating. You know, all of the southern states, as a result of the Civil Rights Act, are required to submit their redistricting plans to the Justice Department. That's been true since 1965 Voting Rights Act. Because of the growth, and I can't explain the details of this, but because of the growth in the minority populations, particularly the Hispanic population in Texas, Texas is now included among the states whose redistricting has to be approved by the United States Justice Department in, of course, the Democratic administration. So there's an interesting wrinkle on the Texas thing.
And as you said, it's in court right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's under review of justice. It's also
under
court.
It's a mess.
And the primary is December 15th.
Yeah. Well, we're going to leave it at that. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit of presidential politics. Just when you thought that you're out, he brings you back in. Hey, it's Newt Gingrich. He's back. We're going to talk about Newt, we're going to talk about Herman Cain and the anti-Romney votes. When we come back, this is Backroom Politics. Oh, by the way, it's happy hour. We're going to order some drinks, some cigars, get our martinis and Jack, and we're going to take this home. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
And if we have a minute, there's a drink, an elephant in the...
And we're back live on...
House.
Wow, here we go. We're back live here on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. I'm your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell, and I'm here with our usual gang of pundits, Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Alan Moore, the Honorable Bob Hines, and the Honorable...
Dishonorable
John Freshman, taking up the left side of the house. We're going to talk a little bit about...
The only honest
man at the table. We're going to talk a little bit about presidential politics. While we were gone for 2 weeks, Herman Cain continues to self-implode. CNN broke the news this morning that Herman Cain is currently reassessing his ability to sustain a political campaign for the presidency. Word around D.C. is he may be pulling out as early as Friday. He made some changes in his campaign today. Chances are those are probably not going to be sustainable. But at the same time, just when he thought his career and his political campaign was on life support, Newt Gingrich comes back. Congressman Al, I'm going to go to you. How do you explain the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, getting a surge in presidential politics in this day and age?
Well, first of all, I don't know, but I'm going to be very careful about saying again somebody else isn't going to make it. You know,
I know. You know, every time.
I'm even leery of writing Herman Cain off. I'm not sure how he did it. Newt Gingrich is brilliant. He made some very stupid mistakes before, and he has certain qualities of his character that do not guarantee he won't make some other stupid mistakes. He's
he will.
but he did that, and the debates have proven to have very great influence on these people. Where they stand in the ratings, and those that do a reasonable job in the debates have been doing well, and those that can't debate where they're damn have sunk badly. So I would say if I had to pick one thing, it's his performance in the debates.
Alan, can you explain the resurgence of Newt Gingrich?
Well, I think that I completely agree with Al that the debates have made a big difference. Not because a lot of people are watching the debates, but because the press is watching the debates, and they magnify what your screw-ups and the lack of screw-ups or the smart comments. And Newt is a very smart and thoughtful guy, quick on his feet, good in that format. And so when people start talking about it, they say, gee, I was surprised at how well he did. Now, having said that, this also speaks to the weakness of the front runner, of the presumed front runner of Mitt Romney, who has just continued to maintain his message and a fairly solid following without it going up a lot or down a lot. And in the search for a good alternative to Romney, we've seen Bachman, Perry, Kane rise and fall.
Right.
And now it's Newt's turn to rise. He's risen a little bit more. It's taken a longer time. We know more about him than we know about those other guys. So if he falls, I don't see him falling off the cliff like some of these other guys did. I think that we're maybe moving now towards a two-way kind of race. The White House would love
a
to
Newt
run
Gingrich.
Against Newt Gingrich because there's a long history and track record that they would have so much fun with.
Bob, you know, we look at Newt Gingrich, and Newt Gingrich has come out and said, hey, by the way, Mitt's a flip-flopper. And Newt Gingrich himself has more waffling than a Waffle House in Florida. When we see, you know, is Newt Gingrich basically playing to the base right now, and is it working for him?
It obviously is working for him. He is playing to the base and a little bit. But let me just step back a little bit and say, I long for the day before great sharing of authority and all the debates and the rest of it, the smoke-filled rooms where senior members of the party would sit down and say, now, who is our best
candidate?
Not
unlike Shelley's.
That's right. who's our best candidate? Who do we have to get behind so we don't have a divided party and a difficult time? Picking the right candidate and running a good, clean campaign as strongly as we can. Quite frankly, if all you want is the best debater, I would say it's pretty hard to beat Newt. If what you want is somebody who can lead, who has good judgment, I would say he is not possibly the best candidate.
But John, when you look at, you know, the rise and fall of the quote unquote front runners, you've seen Mitt Romney actually just stay low and slow like a brisket. When you see this, oh come on, everybody's
good,
laughing at that
good
analogy. That's a great analogy.
I loved it. I'm laughing.
When you look at Romney's campaign, and by the way, Romney today just picked up 3 key endorsements out of a key swing state in Florida, which is going to be very big money for the Romney campaign. But when you look at it, you know, does it strike you that maybe we're pushing out the primary too far out from Election Day? I mean, to the point where it's almost nebulous right now?
Oh, yeah. This season has started way too early, and it's way too busy, and it's way too frantic as people search for the anti-Romney, you know? I mean, and I think, frankly, that Gingrich is the, you know, the flavor du jour. And, you know, the press has always been fabulous at build them up so you've got something that's worth tearing down. I mean, that's what they do. But before we write the distinguished former speaker off completely, let's remember the famous words of Richard Nixon in 1962 when he lost a governor's race to the father of the current governor, Edmund G. Pat Brown. He said, I'm through with politics. You won't have me to kick around anymore. 6 years later, he's president of the United States. So this is still, even no matter how far he goes, it's still not necessarily the most improbable comeback ever.
Well, I agree. Well, but when we look at Mitt Romney, I mean, you ask anybody here in town, it more than likely will be a two-man race going into the RNC, the Republican National Convention. Can Newt really pull out a sustainable campaign against a White House that arguably is kind of weak right now?
Well, you have to let me quote the distinguished gentleman, Mr. Frank, who said, God is good. He has allowed me to live along as a Democrat to have the possibility of letting us run against Newt Gingrich.
Alan, is is the representative from Massachusetts that far off? Is this a blessing for the Democrats?
Well, I think they think it is, and it's hard not to see it right now. we'll have a hint here very soon, because the White House has been running some ads against Romney, because on the assumption that he had it locked up and we want to start defining him and undercutting him. We'll see if they continue to spend that money or if they hold back and let Newt and Mitt beat on each other for a while. And Newt, who pretty much through the debates has kept his focus on the president, but just in the last couple of days was beginning to take some shots at Romney. They, not over-the-top grotesque things, but needles that he's sticking into Romney's side. The White House view, I think, will be known in the near future here in seeing how they spend their money.
But we saw a Romney campaign ad that came out recently. It ran here inside the Beltway. It ran in other major markets where it quoted, quoted the president saying, if we talk about economics, we're going to lose. Now, everybody is now seeing the talking heads, and they've all said, well, that was taken out of context. And a lot of people try going after the Romney campaign, saying that's dirty politics. Is this a sign of things to come, do you think, Bob?
Yes.
Is it a good thing?
Probably not.
Alan,
let me go back to one thing about Gingrich. I think that anybody who goes back and looks at his legislative record and things he said in the last 15 years, I mean, if you think that Mr. Romney has, quote, flip-flopped. Newt has flip-flopped.
Yeah.
He's got a lot more.
I mean, like that. Say that again.
And his is on the record.
The fact of the matter is that, you know, people have been looking for, quote, an anti-Romney because he is a flip-flopper or whatever. The fact of the matter is, when people look at the record, if voters look at the record that Mr. Gingrich has, they're going to say he's got more of a record in that area than Mr. Romney does, and on top of that, he has had ethical challenges in the past. He's on his third wife, and I think a lot of the people who are pretty conservative in the Republican primaries are going to wonder if that's the kind of guy they want. Just because he's a great debater doesn't make him the guy you want to run for president.
John Freshman.
Don't forget, we haven't had a single vote yet. Not one.
Right.
Iowa hasn't met. I can't imagine Iowa going for Gingrich. We'll see. New Hampshire hasn't met. So we get a little breathless a little early as a result of polls and endorsements. Well, endorsements, you know what they're worth.
Congressman Allen.
Bob said something about the smoke-filled room. If the four or five of us here were in this smoke-filled room and it was up to us to come up with the Republican candidate, and that would mean all the Republican machinery and whatever would come into play and what have you, and we could make a candidate really fast, wouldn't we come up with the former governor of Nevada? Or Utah?
Huntsman?
Isn't Huntsman, in terms of a bunch of guys sitting around figuring out how does our party win and who's the best candidate and who's the best one that can go up against Gingrich,
against Obama,
wouldn't we go for him?
Well, but this,
I'm not sure. We might go for a Mitch Daniels. We might go for a Tim. Tim Pawlenty, Chris Christie. And while we're at it, we should say, and what would this group come up with on the Democratic side? Well, we might go with Hillary Clinton.
But this brings up a good point: has the National Committee lost control of the electoral cycle when it comes to the presidential politics?
Of course,
absolutely.
Would the current Republican slate be as dysfunctional as it is if Haley Barbour is chairman of the RNC?
No.
No.
Yes.
Alan, why?
Yes.
Because the party chairman doesn't control this.
No.
No, but
it's not a knock on Priebus that
whoever he is
step forward and have and have spent money and raised money and gotten press and gotten a following. I think we exaggerate the power of a committee of a national chairman if we think that he can control this stuff.
It's not so much a question of control, but let's put it this way. And I have no brief one way or another on the present chairman because I don't know the gentleman and he hasn't had a chance to really do that much. But certainly, someone like a Ray Bliss, someone like a Haley Barbour, people like that were, and of course it was a different day, but they were much stronger people. And they had much more ability to work with the governors, to work with the national leadership, and to help direct things.
I'll bet you for one thing, you'd have fewer debates.
Yeah, John, we wouldn't have as many debates, and that's a good thing.
All right, John. But the Republicans who've been extremely successful in presidential politics, particularly in the last 30 or 40 years, have always been the party of primogeniture, and John McCain was the last gasp of primogeniture. You wait your turn, you get your turn, you get nominated. You know, Reagan, Bush, Dole, McCain, and that's gone. I'm all the way with Alan Moore. You could have, name him the Postmaster General, or anybody could be head of the party, and it wouldn't make any difference.
But when we also look at this, we also see that,
Jim,
you know,
Farley.
Wow, there's a name from the past. When we look at this functionality of the current Republican slate, obviously Democrats, I don't want to mention any names, Congressman Allen, John Freshman, are absolutely excited about this, but does the amount of debates, does the fact that we push this out so far, does this contribute to the complacency of the electorate, and is that a bad thing right now? John?
I think it contributes to voter exhaustion, and we've talked about this before. What you have in these states of Iowa and New Hampshire is a very, very small group of people deciding who's the front runner when they leave there, and by the time you get done with Ohio, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida, you're pretty much going to know who the nominee is. And it's more like it's just such a small group that it's very difficult not to, as we talk about in House races all the time, it's very difficult not to play to the base constituency. And, you know, Richard Nixon again. I mean, you know, campaign from the right. When you get into the general election, run from the center.
Congressman Al, you agree with that?
Mm. My mouth was full.
The only time you're speechless.
That's right. No, I think what he said is correct. And I had another thought, which I just swallowed with my martini. I don't remember what it was.
Well,
but Bob,
you know, it's not so much that the campaigns of the candidates have started so early. As a matter of fact, in one sense, it's been fairly late. I mean, people came in fairly late, like Perry. What's different is all the debates, all the publicity about the debates. You know, the groundwork, building your team in Iowa and up in New Hampshire in the early primaries, didn't start any earlier than it has started years ago. But years ago, there weren't any debates until much later in the season. We had debates in September?
Yeah.
Now, we didn't have that a decade ago. They started later. They started basically after the first of the year. We have so many debates now. We've had, what, 9 or 10 debates?
We've had a lot of debates, and I think that something to be said in favor of the debates.
I'm not knocking them. I'm just saying
right. That's
what's changed.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be that we come out of Iowa and then New Hampshire, and we didn't have as much knowledge about these people. We didn't have a sense of who they were. We didn't have all these sound bites from the debates that the news people talked about over and over and over. The debates helped make Herman Cain. They helped kill Rick Perry, and they made a huge positive difference for Gingrich, and I think they were helpful to Romney, who was credible and consistent, and so on.
Exactly.
So,
right.
So now, having said that, we're going to have these first few states, and if somebody prevails in the first three or four, this one's interesting because if Gingrich should prevail, he still doesn't have a lot of money or organization, and I'm not convinced that even if he were to prevail in the first one, if Romney makes a decent showing, Romney with money, Romney with organization, he doesn't, I think, just say, oh, we're done here and bow down. I think he'll keep this going for a while. Meanwhile, the press and the White House will start paying more and more attention to, okay, how do we make the case against Gingrich? And we're going to be reminded of, because it's mostly old stuff, not new, flip-flopping on issues, flip-flopping in terms of his wives, and all sorts of other stuff that that we remember that we didn't like about Gingrich, and questions about his ability to be an executive,
right,
as opposed to a good debater. So even if he should have a surge and prevail, I'm not convinced that ends it for in his favor.
Bob,
to make to carry on the point that Alan is making, which I think is right on, what is interesting is up until about a week or two ago, Romney was basically not doing much in Iowa. Now he sees that he's got to go back into Iowa. Now it's a little bit late, but he's going back into Iowa. He's spending money there. He's putting people on the ground. He's having doing some advertising. He recognizes just what, you know, you can't give one away, because with all the debates, people know more about what they believe about the candidates than they used when they used to know, because they didn't know the candidates nearly as well as they do, as they believe they do, with all the debates they've seen. So now, if you want to strengthen yourself, not only do you have to be in debates, but you're going to have, he's going to have to go, Romney has gone back into Iowa to build somewhat of some strength, and it may be too late, it may be late, I don't know, I don't know enough about Iowa, but it's interesting that he's changed his strategy, and I think it's primarily because the public knows, the voting public and the Republican side knows more about the candidates than they might usually have known.
But what is the basis for this ideal candidate that's called not Romney? Why can't somebody like a Mitt Romney? Is it because he was the governor of a liberal state like Massachusetts? Is it because of the fact that
he was pro-choice?
Is
he
the
was
fact
pro,
that he's a moderate?
He was pro-health care, which to me is... all the things I like about him were the problems in the Republican primaries. You know, he was reasonable on immigration. He had to run in Massachusetts, for Christ's sake. I mean, cut him some slack here, but the Republicans, and particularly the Republicans that are organized and vote in primaries, are looking for, you know, orthodoxy on the issues that they have burned the torch brightly on. And I think, personally, and I'd love to play this out with you over the next 6 months as we watch it together, which we will do, I think personally that the Romney candidacy is going to be a big problem. People say, well, they'll unite behind him eventually. I think there's a lot of people in the party, I've heard him say it to me, who say, this is our chance, this is our turn to get somebody who believes what we believe in. Let's go ahead and let Obama win, and we'll get it right in 2016. I've heard that a lot.
But if you look at 2016, yeah, the name that keeps popping up in 2016, should Obama retake the White House, is Chris Christie, who's not exactly
Marco Rubio.
Yeah. Marco Rubio, we've heard that, but Chris Christie seems to be the flavor of the month when you talk about a 2016 run for a Republican, and he's not exactly the poster child for staunch conservatism.
We can't guess what's going to happen a month from now. For us to talk about who the ideal candidate
I wasn't talking about that. I don't think a lot of Republicans are going to stay home.
No, I agree with that. I think would be the height of arrogance. I mean,
right.
Republicans are going to stay home. Some of them are going to stay home no matter who they pick. And because, believe me, if Gingrich is the candidate, there are other Republicans who will stay home too. But Obama's got that problem. You know, we haven't talked about the president. Let me just say a couple things that were significant in the last few weeks.
We're going to get to him here in the last part of the segment.
Okay.
Go ahead,
take it
off.
Well, I'm just going to say that there was a really interesting piece by two longtime senior Democratic pollsters, Pat Cadell and Doug Schoen, who basically said Obama has failed. He's not taking off. He should step aside and make room for Hillary Clinton. Fascinating, given the source. It's not a credible scenario, but really interesting that they would go public and that they would say that. In the meantime, Chris Matthews, whatever one thinks about him as a TV guy, he has been number one cheerleader for the president. He's the guy who talked about the chills that went up his leg whenever he heard President Obama speak. He gave a devastating critique in the last week about what the president has not done, his lack of enthusiasm, his lack of outreach, his lack of vision, his lack of message on where he wants the country to go.
Lack of a majority.
So it's not just effectiveness. It's what does he stand for? Where's he? What's he saying? And I just found it really interesting that people identified in a particular way are willing to stick their necks out, because you piss off a lot of people in your party when you do that to make a point. And I find that indicative of a lot of question and concern inside the party.
But ironically, Congressman Al, I'll pose this to you. This strikes me as being somewhat similar to a 2004 Bush rerun for the White House. It was, who is the lesser of the two evils? Do we go for, you know, a boring, tall, starchy senator from Massachusetts, or do we keep the gunslinging Texan in the White House? Bush got reelected, even though he was not the most popular president, and he had political problems of his own. Does it give you a little bit of satisfaction that Obama could be in the same position that Bush was in 2004?
That was the longest question I ever heard.
I had to set it up.
At least
I didn't say Costa Rica this time.
I'm still lost back in the middle of the setup, as a matter of fact.
Is this 2004 all over again with Obama?
No, I don't think so. I think that that there are always many differences. I think Obama, when he gets back out on, when he gets focused down to him and a republic,
right,
then the strengths Obama had as a candidate when he first ran will come back. The ability to give exciting speeches and all of that stuff that may not make a damn about whether you're a good president or not, but it sure as hell makes a big difference about whether you're a good candidate. And so I have long felt that many people have written Obama off way too soon because he's not even into the area where his strength is.
So in other words, it's 2004 all over again.
I think it's 2000. I think it's 1996 myself.
Really? You think that the Clinton re-election in 96 is similar to what we're doing with Obama?
Clinton Dole.
We need a candidate.
I really do.
We need an opponent, and then we can better assess.
If it's Gingrich, then I would say, okay, is Gingrich the John Kerry to Obama as a George Bush?
Romney's a different matter. You don't dislike Romney in the same way. That would be more like 1996.
Least we forget, if you take a look at the electoral votes, where they are, what the states are, it is probably fair to say that you could line up probably 235 electoral votes that are going to go for sure for the president. Now, that only means he's about 30 or 40 votes. Ohio.
Florida.
Florida. You know.
Ohio, Florida.
Yeah.
Ohio,
Michigan.
Florida.
Yeah. Michigan.
Michigan.
There are, he doesn't need very much.
Those aren't good states. Easy states for him.
No, they're not. But he won Virginia last time.
But Virginia's got itself another issue right now. Virginia is a different electorate now.
Sure.
You've got a Republican
run. It's a very different situation.
Legislature that can go red very easily.
He won North Carolina.
And you've got a hell of a Senate race in Virginia.
Hell of a Senate race.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of money going on that campaign that might not necessarily go to a presidential campaign for Obama.
But the fact of the matter is, no Republican that you could name has 235 or 40 votes locked in. The president hasn't locked in, so we got to remind ourselves, he may not be the most fantastic guy we've ever had, but he certainly has a lock on a substantial number of votes. It's going to be very difficult.
Bob, are you saying that Obama's not the lame duck incumbent that everybody's making him out to be?
I certainly am.
Alan, you agree with that?
Of course. Nobody's lame. I mean, he's not a lame duck incumbent, and no, I don't, you know, when my buddy Al here talks about all the people writing Obama off, I don't know who's writing Obama off. I think that Obama's still the favorite to win, and we don't know who the opponent is, and we know that...
Well, let's redo that question.
We know whoever the opponent will be is going to have some fundamental weaknesses that they will be able to attack. The president's vulnerable, no question about that.
Let me ask this question, and I'll go around the horn. Is this presidential election in 2012, is this Obama's to lose? Al?
Yes.
Al? Yes. Bob?
Yes.
John?
Yes.
I guess we're all in agreement, guys, and that never happened.
And if you watch the weekend
talking head shows,
that's where you hear people writing Obama off with some regularity. In a lot of those shows, they say, da-da-da-da-da.
Al, find something else to watch on television.
Wait a minute. In support of our friends at NBC, we love Meet the Press.
Listen, on behalf of NBC, my former employer, I would suggest to Al, on Saturday you can watch Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. They're wonderful.
Wow.
and there's not a lot of difference. And
that's right.
Valid point. John, I'll give you the last word.
What I hate about this elongated process that we've all been discussing, and we get fascinated by it too, is that it distracts us from the fact that we've got real important issues in this country, and we get one president at a time. I don't mean to be preachy. I'm guilty of it, too. We get one president at a time, and we got a lot of stuff to deal with. And to put all of that on hold for a year while we wait to see the outcome, to me, is collective irresponsibility.
Right. Here, here.
Here we go.
I want to make a point that is utterly useless because it isn't going to happen, but this country... in so many ways needs to do some structural reform on how it does things.
Right.
And it goes from redistricting to the
nominating. Oh, that's a whole other show,
Al. Filibusters.
No, I'm just talking about filibusters in the Senate. Just some general restructuring so that it will work. That won't last long, but bottom line is you can't do it. You can't wave a wand and restructure it. But that's
we've got a caller.
Got a caller.
Caller.
Hey, this is Dakota. How are you?
Fine. How are you? What's your question?
Just checking in from Oklahoma, enjoying the show, listening to you guys.
Dakota, how are you doing?
Doing well.
Republican congressional candidate for Oklahoma's 2nd District. How you doing, my friend?
Doing well. I'll tell you, it's interesting hearing what you guys have been talking about, because that's what I've been hearing on the campaign trail here. Questions about the presidential lineup, and everybody kind of scratching their heads about when this thing is going to settle in. And I think it'll be a little while.
Dakota, what are you getting as far as the general consensus, as far as is it the anti-Romney vote, or are they just looking for that strict conservative, back to old GOP politics candidate?
Yeah, well, that's it. They're looking for a strict conservative. I mean, in Oklahoma generally, and in this particular district, 2nd District, which is the eastern third of Oklahoma, they're looking for a strict constitutionalist, somebody who's conservative across the board, culture, religion, Second Amendment, again, going back to the 10th Amendment, the belief that the government is just stretched way beyond its legal bounds and all. And so they're looking for a candidate that reflects that. Yeah. Immigration keeps coming up, and certainly the fiscal problems is at the top of everybody's list. So what I've been gathering going across most of the counties here, 26 counties, is that Romney is not doesn't engender a lot of enthusiasm. He doesn't rally the troops. The folks were very positive on Governor Perry until he keeps shooting himself in the foot, on the debates and all that stuff. They like Gingrich's brilliance. You all were already talking about how he plays so well on the debate stage, but there's the personal baggage that comes along. And once you get past that, you find that Herman Cain gets a lot of support. People were really, really big on Herman Cain in this part of the country. But these latest things that have come up with the 13-year affairs, the allegations, et cetera, have got people kind of second-guessing that as well. So the field has just got to settle out here in the next month or two, or, as you all have said, it's going to be Obama's to lose.
Hey, Dakota, the general consensus out there in Oklahoma, is the electorate just becoming tired, or as John Freshman put it, are they just suffering from election exhaustion right now?
Those that are passionate about elections and about politics are following it closely. Most of the other folks are still kind of in the Thanksgiving, Christmas, let's get past the first of the year. And I think once we start having the primaries in the various states, then general interest will pick up. So the general mood and level of interest is there's a lot of talking going on. I haven't settled in on my guy because you see this almost like popcorn. You know, somebody will be the favorite this week, and then the next person is the favorite next week. You've seen Bachman and others just really kind of fall off the radar scope. And so I think most folks are taking a wait-and-see approach. They'll see how the primaries play out in January and February and then really ramp up to get deeply interested in the late February, March timeframe.
John Freshman's got a question for you, Dakota.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
Joining us. You're out there, and we're notoriously inside the Beltway. But do you have a particular presidential candidate that you favor in the Republican Party?
Well, it's the one who's not getting any press at all, and that's Rick Santorum. I mean, you know, it seems to me that in these debate formats, the folks that come up with practical ideas on things that you can actually implement, accounting for all the factors that have to be considered, you know, across the nation and inside the D.C., some of the most common sense suggestions and most consistent suggestions have been coming from Santorum. Whereas what I've seen with Romney and Perry and Kane and these others is that they're all trying to gauge the mood of the electorate. And it almost seems like they're trying to play to the public's desires as opposed to really saying what they truly believe, arguing why that's, you know, a practical or the most realistic approach to solving a problem and just making their case. So I think folks get really jaded when you see all this political maneuvering because it just emphasizes politics as being politics as opposed to being a leader laying out your agenda and then arguing vociferously why this thing is the best solution.
Dakota, Congressman Al's got a question for you.
Yeah. Given what you just said, how are you handling these issues? Because
I'm finding
a principle.
Yeah, I find that my particular effort's been playing very well because where I'm coming from on issues is based on, you know, 20, 25 years of dealing with the world, you know, outside of D.C. and seeing what other countries do and what kind of threats and challenges face our country and where our strength as a country really comes from. It's the public, it's free market capitalism, it's the idea that a person can try things and do things unencumbered by lots of regulation and those kinds of things, right? So as a country, we've been shooting ourselves in the foot, and it makes us more at a disadvantage relative to other places outside the world. So when I lay out these arguments and I talk about, you know, why an expansive government is injurious to our interests and, you know, why high taxes and regulation, those kinds of things, it really resonates with folks. And the frustrating thing I'm finding being new to the political scene is just some of the things that go on in the background where, you know, you've got rumor mills to deal with and misperceptions and people just don't take the time to actually do, you know, some independent research. And so you have to get past that and deal with the politics of politics. And so that's been the frustrating thing for me. But when you actually have a discussion and you get into the Q&A piece and you got more than a 2-minute, hi, I'm from this town, and, you know, this has been my particular story over the last 20 years, when you can get past that, it seems to resonate really well with folks.
Have you tried at all to suggest that you would try to be part of getting things moving and getting things done rather than just stonewalling anything that didn't fit into...
Absolutely. And what I've talked about is the approach that you all have taken about reintroducing civility into politics, the whole First Congress approach, and people are ready for that. They're tired of the partisan bickering. I do know that when you use the word compromise, people interpret that in a negative thing. It's like you're capitulating or compromising your core ideals and values and those kinds of things, and it was never meant to be that way. Mm-hmm. It's finding that 70 or 80% common ground between two sides and determining what's best for the country and pushing ahead. And people are hungry for that. That's what they want to see at the national level. That's what they want to see, you know, occurring in Congress, and they're not seeing it all. I mean, going down in flames with the super committee, you know, is just is a case in point.
Well, you certainly come from a state, and I will say for the record, which everybody knows, that I am a lifelong Democrat, but you come from a state that has one of the greatest leaders in the Senate right now in Tom Coburn. I think he's just an incredibly admirable guy in every possible way.
Sir, he is loved, especially in the eastern part of the state, because that's where, you know, I'm at, but across the state. And what people like is he tells it like it is. He says, yep, look, folks, this is the challenge we've got. This is what we need to do to get things done. If I disagree with you on something, I'm going to tell you why I disagree with it. And if we can't agree, then we'll just agree to disagree. But I don't hate you, and you don't hate me. And he's just been very blunt. And that's what people are wanting, is realistic appraisals, action to actually fix the problems we've got, whether it's, you know, reducing entitlements or reducing the size and scope and expansive reach of government. And, you know, you throw out a $9 trillion plan like he has, and it's, you know, back in black, and it's just that people are eating it up back here. They love that stuff.
Dakota, how's the campaign coming?
It's going well. I mean, every time I get in front of a group and we're actually able to have a discussion, it goes really well. Come away with, you know, some great supporters, and, you know, people want to introduce me to other folks and all, and, you know, that's the way you build networks and all that. But it's just, you know, coming across as is, you know, who you are, and not being you know, pretentious about something or misadvertising, you know, what your personal history is. And you know, people are looking for a genuineness or authenticity. They don't like politicians, you know, per se, somebody who's putting on airs or trying to, you know, make themselves out to be something they aren't. And you know, who could not like a Marine? I mean, come on, you know.
Exactly. Hey, Dakota, by the way, just to break in real quick, there's breaking news coming out of CNN right now. Standard & Poor's has just reported that they have downgraded a good chunk of the major banking institutions here in the U.S., which includes Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Citigroup, and a few others. That's going to be huge, huge names that are going to be out there. And that's probably something you'll feel the pinch on out there in your district out there in Oklahoma.
It will. You know, you saw the news on Fitch, right, that they maintained the AAA, but they changed their outlook to negative for the U.S. And when S&P did the downgrade to AA, what, a few months ago?
Right.
They said, look, you know, there's a lot of resiliency and depth to America and to its economy. Our problem is, you know, Standard & Poor and Fitch as well, that we don't see any productivity going in D.C. to fix the fundamental infrastructure problems to the U.S. financial section. And so if you can't put together a plan that shows any kind of hope of solving the underlying problems, then they're not confident of the long-term outlook. And we're going to see more of this, I think.
Well, Dakota, you know, we'd love to see you next time you're up here in D.C. You know, you've always got a seat here around the table here at Shelley's. So anytime you'd like to call in, let us know. We'd love to have you on the air, Dakota.
But I'm sorry to take up some time. I'm waiting to hear your What Do You Know segment here, so hopefully I haven't gotten into that too much. You know, you guys are always got your thumb on the pulse.
That's coming up here shortly, Dakota. Dakota, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for checking in with us here on Backroom Politics.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Great.
That was Republican congressional candidate for Oklahoma's 2nd district, Dakota Wood, who's got himself a nice little primary race going, but he's been on the show a couple of times, good friend of the program, and actually, you know, shockingly, one of the more moderate, common sense guys running in national political.
Yeah,
right,
what
now.
Possible chance could he have to get elected?
No, that's the problem. No, he's going to get elected. He's
sounded to me like a common sense conservative.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's good. This didn't sound moderate.
You know what? With that, it's 10 minutes till the end of the show. We're going to go around the table. It's time for my favorite part of the show, Tell Me a Story, where we talk about all the news, the buzz, the gossip going around D.C. and outside the Beltway that might have effects on the political scene coming up in the next few weeks. Today, you know what, John, since you're here for the first time in weeks, we're going to start with you. Tell me a story, John.
The story that I want to tell you is that the two key states in the outcome of the Senate, which is still likely to go Republican, are very contested, and the Senate has become much more interested, and it's certainly interesting. It's certainly not a slam dunk. The races that matter are Nevada and Virginia. Incumbent Democrat liberals are safe in Pennsylvania and Ohio, which we never thought was going to happen. New Mexico is leaning Democrat, although they haven't finished their primaries. Claire McCaskill is climbing in Missouri, and the Senate is not the slam dunk, even though the Democrats have to defend 24 seats and the Republicans are defending 10. So I think we need to watch that carefully. In any event, 51-49 doesn't matter either way, except for the Supreme Court.
How important is Virginia to the Democrats?
Hugely important and very much in play.
Does Allen give you guys a little bit of pause?
I think that Allen's going to have a hard time. He could beat probably anybody but Tim Kaine. I think Allen's got a very tough race, as does Kaine. I would expect Kaine will win that race, and I would expect that there'll be a small bump of some kind for Obama. The demographics of Virginia have changed. I have to make one more quick point. We can dwell on it later. The defense cuts are aimed, and the cuts in the federal government are aimed as a dagger aimed at the heart of Virginia. They are the single largest recipient of federal funding, not on a per capita basis, on a total basis in the country.
Wow, interesting. Bob, tell me a story.
It is probably the case that Mr. Kaine will announce within the next few days that he is out of the race.
Yeah.
C-A-I-N, Herman Kaine. Where do his votes go? That's the question. My guess is they're going to go to Gingrich.
Probably.
On a 2-1 basis.
Right.
After that, it's going to be interesting because that's going to mean that there's fundamentally two candidates probably by middle of December.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see where they break because, as I said earlier, if voters think that Mr. Romney has flip-flopped on issues.
Wait till you get a load of Newt Gingrich.
And Mr. Romney doesn't have the problems of former ethical questions for which he left the Congress. And he has been married 3 times.
When are we going to start seeing the bottom tier roll out? Do we have to wait until New Hampshire or Iowa before we start
seeing them roll out? I think at least Iowa and probably New Hampshire.
Okay. Interesting. Alan, tell me a story.
Thursday, December 1st, is World AIDS Day. Now, that's not a big item on most people's mind, but it's symbolic and a reminder of the extraordinary work that the United States has been doing, particularly in the last 10 years, to combat this global plague. We have stopped increasing spending. We've started to see it come down, partly as a result of the budget challenges, needless to say, and partly there's a question of the priority of the president. President Clinton dropped the ball in the first part of his administration. He's done fabulous work since leaving office, but he really dropped the ball early in the 90s. And the question now for this president is he going to put chips on the table and demand that we continue to at least hold the line on spending on global aid? If we fail to do what's something that we've done so much good in, it'll be a stain on his legacy.
You know, you bring that up. You know, a lot of people don't give a lot of credit, and I wanted to ask, why doesn't President Bush get a lot of the credit due to him as being almost a front runner in that campaign?
He did more than anybody ever did.
I wanted to say that he deserves that credit, and he should get more.
Yeah, he should get more.
Absolutely.
I agree.
And most people believe it was the best thing he did in foreign policy. He continues to labor in those vineyards, but I think there's still a residue of hatred and disrespect for Bush. But this is an area where people who pay attention and are knowledgeable all give him enormous credit, which he deserves.
Congressman Al, tell me a story.
This is about a fifth level down rumor moving around that I just have to pick up on about a.
Al, get closer.
Bob is telling me I better talk into the microphone.
No. Only if you want to be heard.
Only if you want to be heard, Al. The six people listening want to hear you.
I am the only one here with a broadcasting background, and I am constantly the one that has to be reminded to talk into the microphone.
Tell your story. We got 5 minutes.
All right. Well, this normally takes seven, but I'll shorten it. This is a very low level rumor. I think there is some merit to it as it relates to this one individual, but I think it has a chance of spreading. And that is a Republican of note who is not involved in this campaign at all. He's off making money. Agreed to meet with Mitt Romney at Romney's request, spent time with him during the morning, had lunch, spent some more time with him in the afternoon, and when he got through, he said, I have no idea what this guy believes. There is no there there.
Can you tell us who the Republican is?
No, I can't.
Wow.
I know.
If you're
going
to say no there, there, you have to properly attribute it to Gertrude Stein in her description of Oakland.
That is exactly true. But what I'm saying is, I think somewhere in this campaign, either toward the very end of the Republican primaries when it's down to a couple of three and they're going, or in the general, where this whole issue of does this man stand for anything, is there anything inside the suit, or is there no there there, is going to become a major problem for the problem.
Wow.
You know, can I just say something? I'm a little concerned with this innuendo, this low-grade somebody said something. Mitt Romney, whatever you think about him as a politician, is a man of great accomplishment as a governor, as a businessman running the Olympics. He may or may not be a great president, but to say there's no there there and sort of attribute it to some mysterious mystery man, I don't know, that bothers me, Al. That sounds a little below you.
Well, let me say that if it is a solid source.
It's an unnamed source. We got to give him credit for that. He is a journalist.
And I started it out, and I said this is about fifth level,
right?
Way down below the normal chit chat. This is not chit chat on the street,
right?
But given the source, which I can't
reveal, right?
Because I promised I wouldn't,
right?
It is nevertheless a very impressive
observation. I will say this though. This is not the first time I've heard that in Republican money-raising circles. Is it valid? I don't think so. But this is not the first time I've heard this.
There are a lot of people who've spent time with Mitt Romney who've signed on to support him.
Right.
And they're not pansies or pushovers. They're people of accomplishment.
I agree.
Too.
I agree.
So let's just maintain a little balance.
There we go. That makes sense.
Wait. Now, I said we're getting into the political period.
Right.
We're going to have some disagreements.
Right.
But I do not believe that I said anything that was out of order, and that's what you're suggesting, Alan, and I reject it.
Wow, we have ourselves a civil dialogue going. My story in the last minute is the Brits are finding out what it's like to be Americans in 1979 Iran. They've got a huge problem. They had militant students storm the embassy this morning. It is a huge, huge problem. Britain imposed sanctions against Iran. Muslim Brotherhood is apparently behind a militant student uprising against the British embassy, where they actually freed the embassy, put up the Iranian and Muslim flags. Iran is now a lit powder keg. That is going to be a bigger news story going down. The Brits are already very concerned about it. The word I'm getting from Britain is it is not something that's going to go away lightly, and it will probably drag in the U.S. here. We're going to see that here in the next week or so. On behalf of Congressman Al, Alan Moore, Bob Hines, John Freshman, welcome back. I am your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell, and our host, Bob Maserati, owner of Shelley's. Thanks, Bob. We love you every week. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Bob?
The place to be.
We'll be here next week here on Blog Talk Radio, 4 o'clock Eastern Time. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Bye-bye.